Let yourself unlearn everything you thought you knew about yourself is one of the many important life lessons George M. Johnson shares with young readers in their new book, All Boys Aren't Blue. George calls the book a memoir manifesto, and in it, they grapple with sexuality, gender identity, assault, consent, and black joy, and I found it to be an utterly invigorating read. Today, we discuss the lessons we're being called to learn and to metabolize from our journey through an immensely challenging year, the important work of making ourselves whole, and love as a starting point for friendship. George shares their thoughts on vulnerability as a necessity for storytelling and why they felt it so important to open the book with a rather bold affirmation, "I want to be immortalized." I'm Josh Rivers, and I'm busy being black with George M. Johnson. George, thank you so much for being here and for making time for me and for Busy Being Black listeners. I'm really grateful.
Yes, thank you for having me today.
The first thing I want to say is I'm so grateful to you for All Boys Aren't Blue and this what feels to me to be an incredible contribution to queer Black letters, as it were. And just reading through, I felt so seen. I felt so recognized. There were so many moments of recognition in All Boys Aren't Blue. And I'm just really grateful that you put yourself, your family, and your story out there like this.
Thank you. I think that's the best part about it is how well it's resonating with so many people, honestly. You're never sure, like, if people read your story and be like, oh, like, you was kind of crazy in the head as a child. So I'm happy to know that I was not alone in my craziness.
Yeah. I want to get to that actually, because you say something that I know how I want to start the conversation. But first, I want to ask you what I've started asking all of my guests. How's your heart?
Oh, see, that's a good question. I'm actually pretty well today. I was really, really sad Saturday. I don't know why I was sad, but I was. And so I just kind of was like, all right, well, I'm going to be sad. I think, you know, partially, I think we are hitting a national grief and mourning period. And I think it's really started to hit us now that we are 1 year in to the pandemic, that things are not going to change as swiftly as we may have wanted them to. And so I think it's just been a little heavy on the heart. Cause you start to miss your family, you miss your friends and like moments, like we lost a whole year of moments and you can't get it back. But I will say today's I feel good and my heart feels good and started a new like daily routine this morning. And so, yeah. Yeah.
And what does that daily routine involve?
Yeah, so I get my tarot read monthly, and I'm very, very into like just spirituality and the universe and how our purpose is and everything. And so my tarot was basically saying like this year is a foundational year for me and will dictate my next decade. And so like I really needed to start to get my practices in order. And so basically this morning I, you know, was like, all right, this will be the first day that I like have a set schedule. Like I wake up, I pray at my altar first, and then I go to the gym, and then it's shower, then breakfast, then like a really, really like scheduled out day of like how my work day should look, taking time for lunch, taking time for rest, taking time for dinner, and then like ending the night off with trying to do some reading. And I you know, wrote out this full schedule and, you know, gonna do my best to try and stick to it. Of course, you know, things will change as life changes and I have more work to do and, you know, TV and on set and all of that, but at least having a morning routine, like before my day starts, and centering myself and talking to the ancestors is the new thing I'm on.
I struggle so much with that, with routine. I find myself like utterly like disgusted at the fact that I might have to follow some sort of schedule. I find it so like so restrictive. But you know, you gotta, you know, if you're like us and you want to help change the world or make the world a better place, it does require a bit of structure. So I'm learning.
Yeah.
You say that you know, you're spiritual and you speak to the ancestors and the universe. Do you think there are any particular lessons that we're being taught or that we have been taught over the past year do you think there are any particular lessons over the past year that you hope land in people's lives? Like, what are we supposed to learn?
Yeah, I think one of the main things, you know, is about time. You know, time is not granted to everyone. And so we don't know, you know, how long a person is going to be here, right? Like, I'm sure before going into the year, no one thought 500,000 lives just in this, you know, country, we're at 515,000. No one thought we would move a year and be less 515,000 people because of this. So you just don't know. And so one is like, you know, giving flowers when people can still smell them, because you just don't know anymore. And I think the other thing that we are learning is, if you are not taking care of like climate, the planet, if you are not taking care of home and taking care of things and taking care of yourself, then the body and the mind and the planet will reset itself. And I think that is something that we all are going to have to take away from this, is that the planet got to a point and reset itself. And, you know, people have been interesting. People have been like, this is the first year we've had seasons. And I'm like, yeah, because less cars on the road, less emissions in the air, less people in buildings, less heating, less this. Yeah, the planet reset itself. And I think that is something that we all will have to take away. And sometimes a reset looks like, and then we always say, like, when we're moving into the dawn of a new era of life, a lot of death happens. Whether it was the Civil War, whether it was the flu, whether it was any time like you see the world like transitioning to whatever the next iteration of the world is, you see a lot of death. And so it's just one of those things that you kind of have to take in. Old folks always say, like, people die when seasons change, you know? And I think we have to, in many ways, look at it from this universal lens of the world's season is now changed. And this new world moving forward will not look like the world before COVID.
Yeah, and we're being called to do something about that, yeah. Right? I think we understand that we can no longer be passive
right.
in this process.
Right, you have to be active in it, right? It's like, and it's interesting, right? Because like, even when we're looking at like the whole anti-racist movement, it's like, it's not enough for you to not be racist. Like the bar is in hell if you think that you are doing enough simply because you are not overtly racist or not racist in your mind, right? You have to actively be doing things to end it, or you are also part of the problem. And so just like you were saying, yeah, we are all being called to do something. Like, you cannot continue to watch death and continue to watch people suffer and think that because you don't overtly play a role in that suffering, that you are doing your part.
I was very struck, very close to the beginning of the book. You said something I thought was quite grandiose, but in the best way. You write, "I want the words of my life story to be immortalized. I want to immortalize this narrative of joy and pain, this narrative of triumph and tragedy, this narrative of the Black queer experience that has been erased from the history books, an existence that has been here forever." And I'm not gonna lie, I like took a step back and I was like, who do they think they are? Like, it's such a grandiose statement. Mm-hmm. And I read it again and I thought, absolutely, right? Absolutely. These, your stories, our stories, this story, the story of your family deserves to be immortalized. I just thought that was such a, not brave, but it was such a bold way, I think, to open this book.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Like, when you know who you are, you just know who you are. And I probably, and my friends will tell you, I go through the biggest denial of who I am. And they're always like, George, you are George, like, you know, accept it. Like, the kids are not calling you their James Baldwin for fun. Like, this book is the book. It is what it is, you know? And so I think it's funny because there are moments where I may write something like that, and that is me acknowledging to the universe, like, I fully understand what this story is going to mean to it. And so this is not for me to be like, I want to be looked at when I'm, you know, gone, my legacy. I want to have a legacy like Toni Morrison. That's not what that's saying. What it's literally saying is, I fully acknowledge and accept what my purpose is here. And I fully acknowledge and accept the fact that this story is going to be immortalized simply because it has to be. Like, you know, we can no longer ignore the story, and we can't ignore it because I'm alive. And I think that's the big difference, right? A lot of us coming to the understanding of who a lot of our queer ancestors were after their death or after their peak. And with my particular story, I've not reached that. I am beginning. And so it is harder to deny a story when the person is still here and actively living the story and the world is watching the story play out.
Yeah, and it's that demand, right? It's a demand that I deserve this, right? And it's explicit, which I think is what is so bold about it, because, you know, we're living lives in social media. As you say, the world is watching, but not so many of us are making that explicit demand that we want our lives to be immortalized, right? Because this is what we're doing. Right? Everything is kind of archived on the internet. We're putting it out there for people to, with intention, hopefully, for people to marvel at, to wonder at, to ask about, to follow. Right. And so I really liked that you said it, that you said this thing that so many of us probably don't have the guts to say.
The back of the book says, be bold, be brave, be queer. It is what it is. Like, I, if I'm going to walk this space, I got to walk it, right? Like, I can't put a story out here and then go hide, you know, that's not that. And that was the decision when I put my faces on the cover of the book, my story, the vulnerability and everything that I told. It wasn't for me. It was because, like, I came to the understanding that, listen, either you're going to do it or you're not going to do it. But there is no in between this time. Like, there is no middle ground with this particular story, especially when we're watching queer kids die. We're watching Black queer kids die or be killed. We're watching Black queer men die or be killed. We're watching Black trans people die or be killed. It's like, no, like, either you're gonna do it or you're not. And so that was really the realization of, again, why I said it's a manifesto. Why I said a lot of bold things. Yeah. I did. It was like, talk your shit, right? And it was like, okay, well, if we're gonna do it, we're gonna do it. Because people be like, you really called your memoir a manifesto? I'm like, I did.
Yeah.
But it's funny now, because now people are seeing the shift happen. People are seeing how it's going in school systems, and people are seeing how cis people are like, damn, I didn't realize it. Like, mm-hmm. We really do some messed up stuff to y'all. It's like, you do, you do. And it's creating a conversation, a national conversation, an international conversation, right? Because the book is now going overseas. Mm-hmm. So it is a manifesto, because it's a declaration of this story, like I said, that's always existed. The main thing I keep saying now, though, like the thing that the ancestors, like, that keeps hitting me is like, I'm not the first one to tell it. I mean, I'm just the first one to tell it, excuse me, or the first one they allowed to tell the story, right? Like, that's really what this is.
Right, okay.
I just got allowed to tell it. Mm. But this is the story of my people from slavery, my people pre-slavery, my people pre-colonization. We always been here.
Yes.
George M. Johnson just happens to be the vessel to tell it. And I get to make the bold declaration in that because I got to tell it. And, you know, and I have the ancestors backing me to tell it. So,
yeah. And I think a manifesto is setting a remarkable intention as well. I remember when I started Busy, I did a statement of intent. And I wanted people to know that this is not this is not supposed to be perfection or right or the be all and end all, but it's just an offering of us trying to figure it out together. Yeah. And I feel like All Boys Aren't Blue does that too.
You're right. It is us figuring it out together. You know, we are moving as a collective now for the first time publicly. And I think that's something we have to talk about. A lot of...
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. I had a conversation with Juby Ariola Headley, whose latest poetry collection, Original Kink, just came out. And he was kind of mentored and had a close, you know, personal relationship with Craig G. Harris. And we had this conversation about, you know, connecting to a legacy before us, and that people like Melvin Dixon and Essex Hemphill and Asado Saint and Craig G. Harris kind of put forward this documentation of their lives, knowing full well that their lives were finite. You know, many of them were dying of AIDS and had to create this kind of prodigious body of work so that they would be remembered. And one of the things that Juby says is that it's actually taken a lot of us a long time to wake up to that call, to respond to that and to decide to do something about it, to carry on that legacy.
Yeah, the work has to outlive you. And I think a lot of people, they write for the moment. I don't write for the moment. That's something I have no desire to write for a moment. The work has to outlive you. It has to mean something to the child that I don't know 50 years from now. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like what my intentions are with anything that I'm creating, is that the work is not just something that lives in that moment. Like, it is something mm-hmm. that can live in any moment and then stand the test of time, as we've watched many texts be able to do, that we continue to read. That was ultimately the intention behind it, was knowing this was not about a moment of telling my story. This was about a text that needed to live beyond me. In many ways.
As I was reading the book, I kept thinking, how have they remembered all of this, all of their life in such detail? I was joking with a friend the other day that I can't remember most of my 20s. And so I'm very curious about, do you have a process for remembering?
That's so funny, because the first time I got that question was yesterday. Someone asked me the same thing, and I was like, I guess I never thought, I guess I assumed everybody remembered a lot of the stuff from their past. I think the best, the kind of explanation I started to go into yesterday was, like, I think it's, I don't know, like, because I talk about a lot of traumatic things. I think I do a great job of connecting who I am now to what triggered it, what triggered the moment. I think a lot of people are working to figure out, like, well, how did I get to be this person today? Like, but I think they don't necessarily think about the moment the thing happened that created the thing 20 years from now that's happening. I do that a lot, though. I'm very self-reflective of, like, well, what moment made me hate smiling? You know, because I knew I didn't like smiling. I never liked smiling. And I was like, well, what moment was that? And, like, I was able to just sit and be like, that had to be the moment. Like, that was it. Like, that had to be the moment when that all started to become an issue for me, right? I'm not big on people coming up behind me or, like, being behind me. And I was like, when did that come from? And the moment in the bathroom.
Just thinking, oh, that's from the bathroom.
It was from the bathroom. To this day, I still have I have to, like, tell myself, like, even like during sex, I have to tell myself, like, this is okay. Like, it's okay. Like, if a person is even, like, on my back or over my back or anywhere, like, in that, I get this feeling that I have to, like, push down to remind myself, like, this is okay. This is consented. This is, like, and I think that's the stuff that I work through. And I my memory is so strong on those things because they never left me. Like, I always held on to those things. And I said, I think it's just a reminder that we hold on to trauma in a different way than we hold on to joy. And I can link traumatic experiences to things that I'm going through today. I can't necessarily link joyful moments to a thing that created something, right? Like, and I think that's the interesting part about memory, is like what gets stored and what kind of just does it. But there are moments for me that they just don't leave me. And I think that's why I'm able to remember them as well as I am.
And there's a tremendous amount of tenderness as well throughout the book. And I was also struck by that, right? That there's a softness around how you describe the people that you love. And it seems to me that you remember very well also the tenderness of the people around you, this kind of really fierce love that you were surrounded with.
Yeah. And again, I think it's because like we just grew up with people that just liked us. Like, I think, yeah, because fair. I think you can grow up like loving people, but not liking them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, now I don't want to say like that's valid. I just think that's the truth. Like, you can have aunts that just don't like their nieces and nephews and siblings. Like, they just don't. And that's the truth of the matter. And we could pretend that that's not what's happening, but it's like, you can have that happen. And when that happens, like, it creates these dynamics of power and control and anger and hatred towards one another. And that's why I always, I talk about it in the book, but I talk about like, I'm not just like, my mother's not just my mother. My aunts are not just my aunts. Like, they're my friends. And we worked to be friends with each other. So it makes it much easier because we're all friends. Like, we don't have to just like rest on love. Like, love is where we started. And that's what Nana would say. Like, you start from love. Like, she was like, the problem is people try to work to get to love. And she like, for her, you know, she like, well, we start from that. Like, the love is there. We got to figure out friendship and we got to figure out like, that's what you really got to figure out is, do I like this person? Because love can be there, but do you like the person? And I think I liked all of my family members and that made it easy.
I'm looking now at Bell Hooks' All About Love. And this reminds me of that, like her calling us not to confuse like and love, or not being liked with being loved, or, you know, this kind of confusion that happens when we just assume that the people around us do love us or do like us. Sometimes they don't.
And that's okay. And that's okay. Like, I mean, it just is what it is, right? Like, I have no expectation to walk this earth and think that everybody is going to like me. I have no expectation walking this earth think that everybody is going to love me. I have no expectation that I will find romantic love, that I will find. Like, I've kind of removed those notions that, you know, I'm unsuccessful if I cannot find marriage or a partner, or that, like, that's just a societal box that I'm unwilling to check. And, you know, if it happens at 35, 45, 55, 65, then it happens. If it doesn't happen, that's fine too. And, but I think we put so much pressure on that, like, forcing our way to love a person, forcing our way to like a person, forcing our way through compromise. I understand the notion of those things, and I understand why we choose to do those things, compromise and certain things, but it does get to a point where is your compromise a deterrent to who you are? Because if it is, then that's not a compromise anymore. And I think I've just learned that there are just certain things that I'm just not gonna do. And that's just that. And that's okay. Like, it may not be okay for you, but it may not be okay for you, but it's okay for me. And and I have to worry about me, you know? And I think that's why I always say, like, people always talk about like, oh, I got to find my better half. And I'm like, I am a whole person. So I don't like work on being whole, hon. Like, you know? And I think, but that's the same with family. Y'all got to work on being whole first. Like, y'all filling each other's voids, and you can't fill other people's voids. Like, I'm not here to fill your voids. Like, we got to come into this as people who are as whole as we can possibly be. And then we can support our whole identities together. But I have no desire for you to try and support half of me when I'm not fulfilled and be trying to always pour it. Like, that can't work, you know?
No, it's not sustainable.
Yeah, at all.
Busy Being Black will return after a short break. I'm Josh Rivers, and you're listening to Busy Being Black. I'm in conversation today with George M. Johnson, whose book, All Boys Aren't Blue, was released this week in the UK. George describes the book as a memoir manifesto and has woven throughout it valuable lessons for an emerging generation of queer Black folk. Throughout the book, you weave these wonderful lessons. And I guess for listeners we should make who haven't yet read the book, we should make clear, because we're not offering any spoilers. I don't know if you noticed that. We're not going to tell them about the smiling or the bathroom. They have to read the book. But you weave through these lessons, these life lessons that are not subtle, but are necessary. For example, I thought of this as you were speaking: let yourself unlearn everything you thought you knew about yourself and listen to what you need to know about those who navigate life outside the margins of a heterosexual box. You know, this refusal not to measure yourself and your success based on a partner or marriage, I think speaks to that.
Yeah, like you just...
Was there someone who gave you the template for thinking outside of that box? If you had to pinpoint someone.
It was probably my grandmother. I mean, she just wasn't restricted to conventional things. Like she never was like this, like my grandfather, like they'll tell you, like my grandfather died in 87. But my mom and I would tell you, like, you know, they always say like, daddy was always like the kind, cool. They was like, mommy was she ran the house. Like she ran everything. She ran the family. She ran everything as a woman, like as a Black woman. And it just was like, there was just never like this notion in her mind of following behind a man, like ever. And I think like in seeing that, like she always owned her own businesses and made her own money and made her own decisions. And no man was like gonna tell her like what to do and how to do it and how she had to be. You know, watching someone like that who just wasn't constrained by the ideals of what a woman had to be or how a woman had to act or how a woman had to present, or like, you know, she just was that type of lady. She was cool. She went to church every Sunday, but she cussed. She just didn't look at things like, you know, she didn't believe in the Bible, like shaming queer kids and shaming gays. And she never believed in that type of stuff. And she never operated like that, even though she could have, because a lot of people in those type of orgs and religions do. And so I think just being different, she just allowed the space for it, because I think in many ways she was different. She just was an anomaly and a force. And I think she allowed me to be that same thing in the world as I am now. You know, in many ways like her.
Yeah, it reminds me, E. Patrick Johnson. I have queer tattooed on my neck. E. Patrick Johnson theorizes that everything he learned about queerness, he learned from his grandmother.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to sit and kind of think about it. But my mom too, like my mom has always been very like about her own business, independent. Like, you know, I just got to really, really be around people who just didn't feel like they had to ascribe to societal things in that way. But yeah, I really do think my grandmother was like that bridge, like of like, if it's something you want to do, you do it. And you got to live your best life for you. Like, don't worry about everybody else. Like, you got to do what's best for you at some point. And that was fully embracing my identity and being who I am, you know?
I do want to talk about hope, if you don't mind. It's one of the stories that stands out for me the most in the book. I think it's just a beautiful story. Tell us who Hope was.
Yeah, so Hope was my transgender cousin that I grew up with in New Jersey. Hope was probably maybe about 10 years older than I growing up. And she was my mom's goddaughter. So Hope, though, is who I would say is like kind of not like, I don't want to say, I'm trying to think of the right words. Like, I don't want to say like my family got to like not test it out, but like basically like Hope was like the first test of like, oh, we have a queer child in the family. Like, there have been other queer people in my family, but I think because Hope was trans, I think it was a different level of like, oh, okay, like this is different. Like, for all of us, like, we really have to figure this out because Hope is transitioning and Hope is telling us who she is, you know, as a young child. We're watching it happen in real time. Hope, though, for me was inspirational. Hope was someone who I could look at and possibly see myself in. I was struggling with my identity. I was struggling with thinking, you know, there were times where I thought I was going to be trans because I was so effeminate. And I just always thought of myself in my daydreams as a girl. And I was processing things through like this lens of being a girl in this particular body. And so to see someone in my family also doing and dealing with that same thing, I think we had like a very, very strong connection to where, you know, she knew who I was, even if we didn't necessarily talk about it. But we had our moments together where we would go to the store and like we had our moments together where we could kind of talk just as cousins. And, you know, you kind of go from this place of like being nervous to be out with her. I was 17 when we would go out, and like, cause you know, people would stare, and like as a 17-year-old who was dealing with their own identity issues, it was already a lot. And then to add that on it, you know, you just felt like overwhelmed by it. But then to grow to this place of where you realize it doesn't matter. And that like for Hope to really live and exist in this world as a trans person, a Black trans woman, a dark skinned Black trans woman in the 90s and in the 2000s, like when there was no, you know, visibility and representation, and there was no, I mean, there still is really no safety, but like we're talking about even worse during those times, right? And be so bold and be so brave to just do that. She really just stands as like this role model that I think so many of us can learn from about, you know, when you choose to be yourself and you choose your own happiness over what society is telling you you can and cannot be. And so, yeah, that's Hope. And like I said, a lot of people love that story. A lot of people are actually shocked by it, I think, because they're like, you really grew up with a transgender cousin. It's like, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that, again, it just speaks volumes when you see who I am today. My family, we've just done really, really well with the protection of queer kids. And but I think the sad part about it is her story also, you know, signals to no amount of love at home can protect us. And although Hope was very, very loved at home and her family, there were societal things took her from us, societal pressures and the things that trans people have to do to be themselves took her from us. And I think that's the sad, unfortunate part about the story. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's beautiful that her story gets to live in the world now. So,
well, like you said, there is beauty in knowing that whichever way I go, I was here and I left here being myself. Your story will now live on forever through my words so that whoever may read them, they can exist because you existed.
And that's truly it. You know, at the end of the day, I think that's what the book is about, right? Like the book is about the child who reads it and now can look at themselves in the mirror and be like, okay, I'm not, something's not wrong with me. There is somebody out here who has lived it. And so I'm not some anomaly. I'm not some mistake. I'm not some new thing that's happening in culture, you know? And I think that's what's most important. And I think for those who are already experiencing it, it's the validation for them that because they've already been going through it. And so it's the validation of, okay, so I did, you know, I did experience these things and it's okay that I experienced these things, but now I get to say it and I get to tell my story too. And I get to live a little differently. You know, the weight gets lifted, I think, some.
I think what's also important about Hope's story is that you show that it's a process. That I think there's often this assumption that Black people show up already knowing everything, that we've figured this out, that we're not also navigating what it is to move through the world, with a trans cousin as you're trying to figure yourself out at the same time and the pressures. And I think writing about that honestly will be so helpful for so many people who need to know that it's okay for them to be figuring it out and showing up as best they can.
Yeah, it's a journey. And I think Hope Story tells it was a journey. And I think, you know, what's great about having another book coming out, it'll also let people see where I'm at on my journey, because the next book talks more about where I am today. And so, I mean, it talks about childhood and everything, but you will hear more about where I am today and my journey. And so I think that's realistically, that's the beauty, like you said, of the story, is that Hope just didn't one day come to the family like, okay, I'm Hope and I'm this and I'm that and I'm this and I'm that. It's like, no, like it was a journey for her and there was a transition that happened. And that transition happens for all of us when we go through young adult to adulthood. And it's one that could be forever happening. And I think that's the beauty of the story though, right? Like you see it play out in real time. And so people, I think it gives them space and it gives them grace to still be figuring it out.
And what has this process been like for you since releasing the book? Because I mean, obviously you go through the process of writing the book and collecting all these stories and memories and making them make sense and putting them in narrative form and what have you. Yeah. But I wonder if you've learned something about yourself in the process that you weren't expecting, or you've been surprised by anything that you uncovered.
I think I learned primarily like that it's okay to be vulnerable in this way. I think I learned that my transparency and my vulnerability is necessary if I'm going to be a storyteller. Like it's necessary. It's not like a choice you can make. It's, you know what I mean? Like it's just not a choice you can make. I think a lot of times, because I get that question all the time, like, well, did you cringe? Did you? And it's like, yeah, like, of course I cringed talking about the first time I bottomed, and talking about the first time I topped, and talking about molestation. You don't just go into that and again, like, I think the thing is, like, if I was writing an adult memoir, nobody would question that. Like, oh yeah, of course we're going to go into, this is a young adult memoir. And I think that is why people were so shocked that it went all the way there, because of who the audience was going to be, 14-year-olds or 15-year-olds. And I think people were like, oh, like you really are telling them the tea. And it's like, well, yeah, like you have to. Because I think the main thing that it really, really released was the fact that we all have the 5-year-old, 10-year-old, 15-year-old that's in us that still feels like it may have been silenced or feels like they never got the chance to say the things. And so I think that's my favorite thing about the book, is that the book is not really written by, it wasn't written by 33-year-old me. It was really written by 5-year-old me, and it was written by 10-year-old me, and it was written by 15-year-old me, and it was written by 21-year-old me. And so I think that's why the book connects so well, is because when you read it, you don't feel like you are reading the story of a 33-year-old. Like you feel like you are reading a 5-year-old who just happens to have the language to say what they felt like. I think you feel like you're reading the 13-year-old who has the language to say what this experience felt like. And so I think that's the beauty in the book, is it's not me at 33 writing about these experiences. It is me at 13 with the language to now finally say, this is what I felt like, this is what it is, this is who I am. And so the younger versions of me got to write this book. And I think that's what I came away with, was it released all of that. And so now I don't think about that type of stuff. Like, I don't get caught up in it anymore. Like, my past and all of that, like, it's gone. Like, I'm happy, you know?
Yeah, and I think about the vulnerability requires you to step out on faith, right? That the community will hold you and hold your story and treat it with reverence and respect. And so thank you for stepping out on faith and for letting us receive it and hold you. I just wanted to acknowledge that vulnerability is powerful, because it requires a great deal of faith.
Yeah, thank you.
Something that also stood out for me in the book, this is selfish, right? Because every time you read a book that someone's written, obviously certain points will stand out for you more than others. But I think your reflection on your relationship with your dad really resonated with me, particularly in as you know, you reflect on that relationship as an opportunity to challenge the role that we're taught heterosexual Black men play in our lives. And I think it's a beautiful and kind examination of who your father was and could be for you. I think it's so important. So many of us are looking back at our fathers now. I'm doing it, saying, was he the monster that I made him out to be? And now that I have more space from it and I have more self-awareness, I'm like, oh, actually, I'm able to move through the world as I am because he was my father, right? He gave me a lot. And that opportunity, I mean, what would you say about your relationship with your father and what you've learned looking back on that relationship?
Yeah, it's interesting because it was tough. Like, it was tough growing up with him in the house. And I always say that. Like, he just was so stoic in many ways. Like, he didn't talk a lot. Like, he talked to, like, men his age, and he would have conversations with them. But, like, in terms of, like, talking to us, like, he just didn't. He didn't like babysitting us. He didn't like, you know, he was patriarchal in that way. Like, he was raised in many ways to think like, well, the woman, you know, the wife takes care of the kids and the wife cooks dinner. And the wife, like, so he would cook for himself. Like, he would do things like that. And you would be like, we're all here, like, too. Like, you could make us dinner, or like, you could cook dinner for everyone. But he would cook for himself all the time. He would do that. He would make his own breakfast and leave us spending for ourselves. And we just would ignore him, like, okay, whatever. But I think when you're going through it, it's tough because as a child, you want to feel love in the way that you want to receive it. And so he showed it through gifts, and he showed it through certain ways that he would support us. But that, I always say, like, you know, it's interesting because everyone's love language is different. And so his way of showing it wasn't always necessarily the best way for all of us to receive it, right? Some of us wanted to hear, I love you. Some of us wanted to hear or get a hug, or, like, you know, like, things that he just was not accustomed to doing. I think as an adult, we have a great relationship. I just saw him the other day. And, you know, we talk all the time now. Like, we don't talk on the phone and stuff as much, but, like, if we're together, like, we talk about current events, talk about what's going on in the world. We talk about, like, we talk, we have good conversations now. And he's very, very proud of who I've become and everything I've become. And again, he read the book. And so for him to read the book and I'd be proud of it, like, cause I didn't say everything I said about, like, in the book, I don't say he's perfect. Like, you know, no. I do say some things like that I don't like, that we struggled with, and that, you know, his stubbornness, I talk about his stubbornness in the book. And he respected it though, cause he understands, like, you know.
Well, and it's fair. Right? It's fair.
Yeah, because it didn't lead me to a place of, like, disdain for him. Like, it just led me to understanding more, because as an adult, I can be that way at times. And my friends have to sometimes tell me, like, I don't like when you're cynical. I don't like when you, like, you do this thing sometimes where it gets cynical. Like, that's what some of my friends will tell me. And so it's like, I have to work on that, right? Or, like, sometimes they tell me, like, George, sometimes you are hard. And they're like, we know why you're hard though, because, like, the world treats you harshly. And so they're like, you know, work on being softer. So, like, that's a thing I work on. I just think I get to do it in real time. Whereas with kids and adults, we don't have that setup where a child can say, like, this hurt me, to an adult.
Yeah.
Adult apologies or parent apologies are few and far between. But, yes. But we see conversations now happening more where parents publicly are saying, like, I do apologize to my child if I made a mistake, or I do apologize to my child. Because you have to, you know?
Yes.
So I think that's where we are, you know, me and him.
And I think it's important, right? We as queer Black people, we make these demands, these rightful demands, that people appreciate us, respect us, love us, and care for us as we are, as we show up in the world, as the people we want to be. But I wonder if we often extend that back, right, to our parents who showed up as they could, did the best they could with what they had, showed love to us in the ways they understood how to, and this kind of reflecting back and having a kind of a fair analysis, as fair as it can be, analysis, I think, is so helpful. It's certainly helped me have a better relationship with my dad as an adult. Like, I couldn't have raised two kids at 27. I couldn't have, you know, flown these kids around the world as part of the military. Like, that's crazy.
I think about that too. Like, I'm 35 and I don't have, like, I would be like, what would I be doing if I had kids right now? Like, I would be nuts. Like, I don't even know how my mom did it. I think about that all the time. Like, how did she raise two kids and work? And like, I'm like, I can barely just raise myself, I feel like, some days. Like, yes, and I feel that. I think about like when I get a cold or I get like sick, I'm like, well, how would I be sick and have kids? Like, what would my, like, I would be in bed, like trying to figure out how to make them bread, and I'm struggling to even get out of my own bed. Like, how did my mom do that? How did my dad do that? So you do, you know, the older you get, you start to process just a little bit differently. Like, yeah, that's tough. That's a tough thing. Like, that we think we are just like, for some reason we call it like natural, but that's not really natural. Like, because it don't just click. Like, nothing just turns on when you get a child that is like, oh, okay, now I can raise a child. Like, you don't know. You really don't know if you can raise a child. When you have a child, you can make the decision to have a child. Y'all can say y'all are ready for children. And when a child get there, you still be like, yeah, we were not, I don't think this is for me. Yeah. And I think that's valid too. This is
a breathing human.
And I think that's valid too. People get married and have kids all the time, but have no space to be like, damn, I'm not good at being a mother, or this is not for me. And we think, you know, and we shame those people like, well, you shouldn't have had kids. It's like, well, you don't know until you have one sometime, right? It's like, mm-hmm. You go buy a Porsche and then you drive the Porsche for 2 weeks. And then you're like, damn, I don't think I like this Porsche. Well, you didn't know that before you bought the shit, right? So you have a child, you whole life, like, oh, I can't wait to have a child. You have the child. And then a couple months in, you like, I don't like this. But you've made the commitment, but that's tough. And so I was like, that's one of those things where I'm always working like grace. That's like my word for 2021 is like, have grace with yourself for things that you may walk into that you then be like, damn, I don't like this. Or I'm not feeling like, and be okay with the fact that like society may be like, what you mean you don't like that? I don't, like, I don't know what to tell y'all, but I don't, right? Like, I got into an argument one time with my friends because I told them, I was like, I don't want to be the primary parent. And it was like, oh no, that'll change. I was like, no, it won't. Like, I have no desire to be the primary caregiver, the primary parent. That is not my role. Like, how would you know that? And I was like, y'all, I think the problem is y'all have not done the work to understand yourself enough to know what your likes are and what your dislikes are. I love my nibblings and I love the kids and I love being able to return them to their parents. I do not have a desire to be someone's primary everything. Mm-hmm. I don't. And that's okay. And I think that is the one thing that my relationship with my dad, he had no desire for that. But I am taught to shame him for that. And I shouldn't, because he just had no desire for it. And he might not have realized it until well into it that, like, this is not my thing. Like, you know, and, yeah. You know, and even with my mom, I think there were times where she was like, you know, I remember the one thing she said. She was like, I was Gregory's wife, I was your mother, then I was Garrett's mother, and then y'all both went to college. And I had to figure out who the hell I was. I'm 50 years old now, I got to figure out who I am. And I think that's the lesson that I've learned is like, when you know who you are, you do know who you are. And I think we should allow our parents and ourselves space to know who we are and have those type of conversations and relationships to understand, like, parents, there is no rule book on how a parent parents. And, you know, my dad, there were things he did not do. And I cannot always be so quick. We can talk about it and we can work on adjusting things and we can do, but I can't just be so quick to throw it away and throw him away, because, like, I would have to throw myself away, because I'm working on, because at some point, one of my nibblings is going to say, like, well, Matt, I don't like that you do this. I don't like, and I'm gonna have to eat it and be like, well, damn, I remember when I didn't like when my parent didn't do this thing. And so it's like, but now we have the conversation. Yeah. That's the difference, right? So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love that. I particularly love the the children as Porsches analogy.
I know everybody will be like, now George. I'm like, I'm just saying. It's just this, it really like, but it's right, postpartum. I mean, but for real, like postpartum depression. And people really, really shame women for that. And it's like, y'all, do you not understand? Like, that's a whole new way of life when you bring a life into the world. And it's just not something you could prepare for or something that you'll know that you'll like.
Yes.
Once it happens.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's an honesty a lot of people don't like to encounter, I think. We're nearing the end of our conversation, and something I flagged and highlighted like a wild person in the book is when you push back against it gets better, you say, make it better. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I remember there was like this whole movement, like there were like these commercials and everything, like it gets better, it gets better, it gets better. And I remember like, kind of like you buy into that, like, okay, maybe that's the truth. Like maybe I am, you know, 21 or 22, still struggling with identity, but maybe if I just keep going through life, it'll just start to get better one day. And then you realize like, it really doesn't get better. Like, you know, you come out, you tell everybody, you invite all these people into your life and into your identity, into your thing. And years later, you're still getting homophobia, transphobia, still getting called out your name, still getting, so like, it just doesn't just automatically get better. And, you know, we say those type of things all the time. Like, it gets better reminds me of like the term hope. Yeah, like, cause you'll hear people say, I hope it gets better. Well, if you can actively make the thing get better for the person, don't hope, do the thing, right? I'm gonna pray for you. And that's the prayer. Like, no, like if you're going to pray for somebody, like legit, go pray for the person. Like, take the 10 seconds to say the prayer for the person you just told you were going to pray for, right? Like, that's an action, right? Prayer is an action. It's not a thought. It's an action. So that's when I say, like, you know, make it better. Like, if you have the power to change someone's existence or you have the power to change someone's livelihood, like, then you just have to do it. Like, you do the thing. But if you continue to sit and wait on hope and continue to sit and wait on just time making things better, like, time doesn't just necessarily make things better. I think about, you know, something I always say is like, listen, like if you're living in a city with homelessness and you walk past homeless people every day, you can do one of two things. You can keep voting for politicians to hope that they fix the problem, or you get to a point where you like, okay, well, maybe I can get a couple of people in the community and we can fix it ourselves. Like, what is it? How do we fix this? Like, y'all are all sleeping under the train tracks. Like, how do we get a building? How do we collectively as a community put this money together and house these people? And how do we do, like, that's how you make things better, right? Like, you just do it at some point. And so I think, especially in this day and age, like, complacency is what kills us. Like, people get so complacent with things. And it's just like, oh, you know, kind of like where we are now, right? Like in America, like we had a change of power happen, but we ain't had a lot of change happen since the change of power. Like, people still waiting on checks. Vaccines.
It's just a different white supremacist.
You know, like it's just not happening. And I think people now are finally starting to realize, like, yeah, it just don't get better. And that's why I said, like, I think we're in a period of national mourning and national grief, not just for the people who have died, but for the time we have lost and for the realization that this shit is just not going to flip. It's not a switch is not being flipped like everybody was hoping for. It's just not connecting as fast. The dots are not moving. And it's simply because you have people who are not making it better. They're just not. They are actively not making it better. And you are seeing how that plays out in real time.
Well, to close, I normally ask all of my guests the same question. What do you hope for? But I think your answer... I think your answer would be...
that question.
I think your answer would be, I don't hope, I do.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's really what it is. And, you know, one of the things that I always teach people about hope is like to not be afraid of hopelessness. Some of the best things that I do have not come from hope, but come from hopelessness. When you get to a place of hopelessness, that is the black saying, you know, we made a way out of no way. The only way that you could know that no way existed is if you got to the realization that there was no way and you still made a way, right? I think that's the difference between hope and doing, right? Hope is waiting on it and waiting on the way to arrive. Doing is acknowledging that there is no way and still making a way. And so, yeah, I just want people to be less hope and more do.
I received that.
George M. Johnson is a writer and LGBTQ activist. Their memoir manifesto, All Boys Aren't Blue, is available wherever books are sold. Busy Being Black is the podcast exploring how we live in the fullness of our queer Black lives. Thank you to our partners, UK Black Pride, Blackout UK, The 10th, Schools Out, and to you, the listeners. Your support of Busy Being Black means the world. Please do rate and review the show and tell others. The more you do, the more people like us get to hear the stories and voices amplified here. And finally, thank you to my friend and co-conspirator, Lazarus Lynch, a musician and culinary extraordinaire based in New York City, for creating Busy Being Black's triumphant and ancestral theme music. I'm so busy being black.